In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We are talking about counting birds, watching birds, and feeding birds. And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, we have an email from Susan. And she says, on my morning dog walks this winter, I've heard what I think is an eastern towhee calling from the woods. I read that they usually migrate. Any speculation as to why he or she might still be here? Oh, Jim, are you there? Oh, there you are.
Yes, I am. Are you yummy? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. It's certainly possible that the towhees, they are occasionally counted on winter bird counts. It's not a common thing at all. And as Doug mentioned in the first part of the hour, increasingly we're seeing some birds winter farther north than they usually do. Part of that might be due to feeding, but more likely it is climate change. I know, for example, cardinals are probably directly due to feeding now winter much farther north. My brother in Ottawa, Ontario, who's lived there for a long, long time, now sees cardinals year-round, whereas they used to just see them during the summertime only. So it's part of that might be farther north winter bird feeding, but certainly climate change, birds like eastern towhees or spotted towhees that normally are only here in the summer are being seen into the winter. So, for example, common all over the state, Canada geese that now overwinter because there's so much open water that used to be all iced up, and plus we have larger populations of geese, of course. And so when birds are, it's one of the advantages to having people out looking, you find some things that generally you don't see. So it's certainly possible. My guess would be though that she might be, unless she can see it, my guess would be that it might be a white-throated sparrow, which is a northern bird that overwinters often down here because of our comparatively balmy winters, that she might be hearing part of a white-throated sparrow's song. They sing, "Oh, Sam Peabody," or they sing, "Oh, sweet Canada, Canada, Canada." And so you might hear part of that sound, and it might sound like the towhee song, which is sort of similar. But it's possible that she's been seeing a towhee, but I think it might be something else.
All right. Sounds like more research to be done on that one. Lots more dog walks to take. All right, let's go to the phones. Ray is on the line in Perry. Hi, Ray.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you for calling, and you're a Christmas bird counter. What was your experience this year?
Well, this is the Dallas County bird count. I don't know how much information you want, but we recorded 57 species of birds in Dallas County in our 15-mile area. Jim was just talking about a towhee. We did not have the eastern towhee, but we had a spotted towhee recorded. And the biggest number of one species, of course, was the Canada goose. We had 411 Canada geese recorded.
Not like our 13,000-plus crows. You don't have a big crow roost in Perry?
We do have a good number of crows that come into town to roost during the night. The people that took part in the bird count, we had 27 observers, and we were divided up into 10 groups. And we drove 22 hours by car, and they estimated it would be 286 miles. And we had people hiking in the various wood areas around. We had 20.5 miles of hiking and 22 hours of hiking. So that's just a breakdown of how the bird count went and the number of participants we had in Dallas County.
All right. And
one other,
go on,
other
Jim.
Other than the spotted towhee, Ray, did you have any other unusual species that you don't expect to see in the winter?
Well, I was surprised by the number of long-eared owls that reported. They're very hard to see, of course, but we had five long-eared owls. My wife and I were out driving around in the southwestern part of Dallas County, and the most interesting bird that we saw, we didn't go to any woods, we saw a rufous morph of a red-tailed hawk, and it was, I got a photograph of it, just a beautiful bird. It's, if people don't know what that is, it's a red-tailed hawk, but it's just about all red or auburn colored.
That's great. That's great. Well, thank you for calling, Ray. That's a great report.
Thanks for sharing that, Ray. Happy counting. We've got Earl on the line next in Grinnell. Hi, Earl.
Good morning. I was delighted to see a hummingbird looking through my window in August, though I don't have a feeder. But what surprised me most was that this was maybe 5 to 10 minutes after the derecho came through with such frosty.
Oh, wow. That is interesting, Earl. And I know a lot of people have been really concerned about the loss of habitat for birds because of the derecho. Jim, what are your thoughts about that long term?
Yeah, the derecho, you know, nature is amazingly resilient. And here in on my own property, we had tremendous damage, lots of tops of trees down and everything. It will be a good thing for some species and a bad thing for others. I suspect, for example, while we already have lots of woodpecker species and woodpeckers in general, we will increase the numbers of woodpeckers we have over the next decade or so as the trees that were damaged die. I've had to create lots of other new brush piles that will actually help not only birds, but small mammals as well, insect populations. So it will certainly change. Whether it will be totally a negative thing, I don't think so. My experience is that nature is resilient. Certainly there are changes over time in the habitat, but the total loss of habitat, if we go from a woodland to a plowed field, that's very different. That's total loss of habitat versus a woodland that gets topped by the derecho or downed by the derecho and continues to be a woodland, albeit not as mature as it used to be. So it's it's a mixed bag for species. Certainly, a rapid change like a storm like that, and particularly as broad an area as it was, can be detrimental to some species, but it'll be good for others in the long run. It remains to be seen, I think, how many of these trees recover next year or don't recover. So that will be interesting to watch.
And it's going to be very different in different parts of the state. I mean, I don't know if you've been to Cedar Rapids. Obviously, most people are sticking very close to home, but the Cedar Rapids area and a couple of other areas in the state were just hit so very hard that the landscape is dramatically altered. Whereas, you know, Iowa City was hit fairly hard, but already, even by the end of the growing season, we saw what seemed like a recovery. When Mark Vitosh, our resident forester, came in after the derecho, he said, "When I'm in Cedar Rapids, the light is white because so much of the canopy is gone." And he said, "When I'm in Iowa City, the light is still green because there's still a canopy that remains." So obviously in some places,
that's a great observation. And in fact, I think in Cedar Rapids, something like 65% of the canopy cover was destroyed. And that's a shame, horrible for lots of reasons.
Yeah.
But in terms of wildlife, it certainly will change the habitat available, and perhaps some of the species will not be there as a result, but other species will take advantage of it. It's just the way nature is. So.
Now, speaking of the derecho in Cedar Rapids, here's a question from Anne. She says, we live in Cedar Rapids, and due to the derecho, we lost our maple in the back, three big white pines. One had a squirrel's nest in it along one side of the house, and our remaining maple in the front is snapped in half. We still have our big ash tree in the back, thankfully. We've bought a bird feeder for birds, which has attracted birds, but we'd also like to feed squirrels, who seem to be scarce. We've not had any come to scavenge the bird seed scattered on the ground. I've read that corn and peanuts aren't the best primary source of food for them. What can we feed the squirrels to support them? Which is probably not a question you've gotten, Jim.
But... Yeah. Well, some people, you know, you like to feed them, and a lot of people do put out ear corn for them, and it's fine for them. They get fat and sassy on ear corn. We have tried that as well to put ear corn out to keep the squirrels away from the bird feeders. But the squirrels have figured out that they really prefer sunflower seed and peanuts.
Okay, so if she wants to feed them corn, though, that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Now, in terms of her habit, I would say plant. When it comes springtime, replant habitat, be it trees or shrubs or some combination thereof, or prairie grasses, or something that increases the habitat for the species that are there. And I know Trees Forever is doing a big effort, not just in Cedar Rapids, but across the state, to plant millions of trees so that they do not suffer for long. So I think that planting in the springtime is really critical.
Well, and... the idea of planting shrubs, that seems like a great supplemental idea to get some habitat back right away. And of course, the trees are a longer term investment. Let's get back to the phones. Right. Ruth is on the line in Ames. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Charity. Happy New Year.
Oh, Happy New Year to you. It's always wonderful to hear your voice. So what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a couple of things. It depends on the time, but in this discussion about keeping squirrels and other little mammal critters away from your yard, not wanting to attract chipmunks that are going to burrow in your flower beds, etc. We have found a wonderful bird food that has a deterrent in it of hot pepper, and you can get that either in a suet feed, a variety of different suet feeders, or in the seed feeders. And that has served to be really very effective in keeping those little mammals away from up close to the house.
Oh, nice.
You haven't found some chipmunks that, a few chipmunks that really like the hot stuff, eh?
We haven't come across that yet. We like it, but we haven't seen any little critters climbing up since we've been putting up the hot pepper feeder.
Okay, very good, very good. I have a couple of squirrels that seem to like it really well. So,
oh no, don't send them my way.
Okay.
They are pests.
Thank you. Ruth brings up a really important thing. I mentioned one kind of feed of the black whale sunflower seed as being the single most. If you've got one feeder, that's probably going to attract the largest variety of birds and be useful to most species of birds. But there are lots of other feeds as well. You can put out suet. She mentioned that you can make your own. If you're a hunter, you can use the suet. Or if you are a beef or a pig raiser, you can use the tallow from animals that have gone to the butcher. You can feed other things as well. I mentioned peanuts, either in the shell, which really seem to attract blue jays. They love them, or out of the shell. And these are waste peanuts. Peanuts are very high in fats and oils. And that's what birds need through the winter, and able to metabolize the fats and the oils in these feeds you're not so concerned about the protein levels, although that's great. But those fats and oils, what they need in order to change food energy into heat energy through metabolizing these foods. And at night, when birds need to fluff themselves up and roost and stay warm, they're changing that chemically changing that food energy into heat energy to stay warm as warm-blooded critters. There are other feeds as well, Charity. A finch feed, which is a combination of sunflower hearts all kind of ground up, and Niger thistle seed is another one. There's safflower, there's cracked corn, there's white proso millet. All of those different feeds fed at different levels in different feeders. The greater the number of the feeders you have in different locations, the more bird species and the more birds you're going to attract. If you're nearby a feed mill or something, you're going to have a lot of house sparrows and a lot of starlings. But if you're in the middle of a city or in the country, it's amazing how many people participate in bird feeding. And it really crosses income levels. It crosses racial and ethnic levels. It crosses all kinds of people from all walks of life that feed birds. In fact, Iowa and the upper Midwest, this is according to national surveys, we have the highest participation rates, not only in hunting, in terms of percent of the population, not only in hunting and fishing, but in wildlife watching, including bird watching and bird feeding in the nation. The whole upper Midwest and Iowa, I think, is fifth in the nation in terms of bird feeding. How much, Charity, do you think that Americans spend just on wild bird seed for bird feeding in this country each year.
Oh,
how much are you supposed
You're just gonna blow my mind. Just tell me, Jim.
It's something like $4.6 billion with a B. It's big business.
All right.
That's what it is.
And it brings us a lot of joy and closer to nature. And it helps those birds be healthier for their migration and all kinds of things. Jim, we're out of time, but what a delightful hour. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I hope everybody has a great year in nature.
Jim Pease is Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. We've been talking about feeding birds in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
It's fundraising week at Iowa Public Radio, and your gift today keeps IPR strong as we continue to tell the stories from where they happen and bring you vital reporting on this global pandemic. Make your gift now and make a real difference at iowapublicradio.org. Thanks.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bird watching, bird feeding, bird counting in Iowa. With me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease and Doug Haar, director of the Iowa Audubon Society. We've been talking about the Audubon Society's annual Christmas bird count. And Doug, before I let you go, for people who are listening who think, ooh, I'd like to get involved in that in the future, how do you get involved?
Well, I think because there's so many counts across the state now, I think it's basically just going online or asking somebody who you know, maybe a bird watcher, where the Christmas bird count might be held and who you'd have to contact. And also it's possible to go online to the website for the Iowa Ornithologists Union, and they will have a list of all the Christmas bird counts that are coming up. They usually post that sometime in December, and that will give you an idea of who to contact or where the nearest bird count might be. So that's probably the best way to do it. One of the interesting things this year, I think, is that so many more people have started bird watching because of the pandemic,
right,
that we've actually got more people volunteering across the state to do this, and probably for the upcoming backyard feeder count here that starts in February.
Oh, that is terrific. And if people are fairly new to bird watching, and Jim and I are going to talk a great deal more about this hour as well, but if this is something you're just starting to get into, do you have a favorite resource for people who want to learn about birds and learn how to identify them, Doug?
There are some good ones. I mean, probably going online to look up the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, they have little online courses that you can take to learn about bird identification. And then, of course, there are bird identification apps that you can buy or even get free. For example, the National Audubon Society has one that's free and will give you identification of almost all the birds in North America. And so you can use those apps to learn about what you're seeing and hearing. And so, yeah, there's just a lot of ways now that people can learn more about birds and really get into the hobby.
All right. It still takes a little bit of study and some careful attention, but just so many resources out there.
It does. There are a lot of resources, and actually we have Audubon members and other ones across the state who work with elementary schools and other organizations to start with kids learning about how to watch birds, too. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways you can do this now.
Doug, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed the visit this morning.
Doug Haar is director of the Iowa Audubon Society. Still with me, of course, is Jim Pease. And Jim, I mean, as Doug said, I'm sure a lot more people have spent time sitting and looking out their windows during this pandemic. But so many people have been. Right. So many people have been hiking and spending more time in nature, which I think is one of the beautiful silver linings of this pandemic. Since it's winter and since we're pretty much homebound right now, let's start off by really talking about bird feeders and how to get started with that. And I think the best way to start our conversation is for you to describe your setup, Jim.
Well, my setup here is a little different than most people's, because we have at any given point during the winter, we have between 15 and 18 different bird feeders out all of our windows here. So I'm looking out to the south here, and I can see 1, 2, 3, 4 feeders up and about 5 species of birds on them right now. I look out my east window from my office, and I can see 3 feeders, and there's a squirrel on one of them. That's a signal to my wife to scare the squirrel off. But we have them out virtually every window. Now, we live on a small acreage, and so we've made lots of efforts over the years to improve the habitat around here, and as a result, we have lots of birds here and other wildlife year-round. Now, not everybody can do that. If you live in an apartment house or you have one window that really looks out in a certain direction, then you might only be able to have one feeder, and that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Even a single feeder, my friend Irv, I know, now lives in a senior citizen's home, and he lives up on the fifth floor, and he has a single hummingbird feeder that he puts up outside his window. And believe it or not, the hummingbirds come like crazy to that.
Wow.
In the summertime. It really depends on the circumstance you're in. You can only have one feeder, and you can only have one kind of feed. I would say the very single best feed that you can put in that will attract the widest variety of birds and be nutritious for them is to put in black oil sunflower seed, just that sunflower seed. You can certainly go to a store and buy these sort of general mixes that they have. Oftentimes, the cheaper mixes are filled with a lot of filler, just that, and it's not feed that is very attractive to birds. And in fact, some of them contain filler that birds simply won't eat. Period. If you're going to buy a feed, I would say just buy black oil sunflower seed, because it feeds the widest variety of birds through the winter time, especially, and will be very attractive to them.
There are people, I think, who feel nervous about the idea of setting up a bird feeder, thinking, am I interfering with nature by putting up a bird feeder? Am I making birds dependent on my support? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's often discussed in bird feeding birding communities in general, and across and in science as well. The data show in a general way. Certainly, there are pros and cons, but in a general way, the data show there's no such that. Yes, birds become accustomed to coming and feeding at your feeders, but they will survive if you have to stop feeding for economic reasons, for moving reasons, for if you're traveling for a few weeks. The birds do just fine without you. They will take their opportunistic, and they will take what is easiest for them to get. And your feeders are very, very easy. The science shows that the dependency on that feed is not a big problem. What we know is that birds that are around feeders a lot tend to come through the year, through the winter, with slightly, very slightly higher weights. So they're healthier come springtime, either to migrate back north or to nest in nearby habitat. And so they have slightly, just very slightly, higher sizes, numbers of eggs, and healthier young. So you have a healthier adult coming through the winter. But those changes are very, very slight and almost not even noticeable. So. Now, the other part of the research is that whenever you do gather wildlife together, and we see these huge populations during the migration season, where you'll see, you know, thousands of geese and thousands of ducks and really thousands of all kinds of things. Whenever you put wildlife agglomerated together, you run the risk of spreading disease more easily. There's no question about that. And with feeder populations, there's been a great deal of worry about that. And so far, this one disease, it's a what's called a mycoplasma disease of one species, a species known as the house finch, that gets this sort of incrustations around the eyes, and the eyes will actually swell shut, and the bird can't feed or protect itself and usually dies in a matter of a few days to a few weeks. And that does seem to spread through feeders, because it brings those birds together a lot. Now, the winter birds tend to be to both roost together and to feed together. In fact, they do that under natural conditions. Of winter flocks of mixed flocks of five or six different species will move through a woodland or through a prairie together because there's safety in numbers. There are more eyes to watch for predators. There's more eyes to find food, and so that they sort of do that naturally. And they often roost together at night in a brush pile or a cedar tree or whatever. And so that's sort of natural behavior anyway. But at feeders, there's a chance that we have more diseases. So far, the only disease that we find that has spread, and it's among only one species of bird, is this mycoplasma disease of house finches. And that can be alleviated by cleaning your feeders once a month or once every a couple of months to get rid of this disease. So but in terms of dependency, it's not a concern. The science shows they come through the winter a little better, but it's not a serious concern for birds.
I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about bird feeding and bird watching in Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions and also your observations. If you are a bird watcher or a bird feeder, you can tell us about the most exciting sighting you've had this year. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And of course, Jim, not everybody is going to set up as many feeders as you have, but if you want to set up a feeder or two, how long do you have to wait before birds start to find it?
Well, it depends, in fact, on sort of where you put the birds, or put the feeders, excuse me, not where you put the birds, and what is around them. They have to feel safe in order to come to a feeder, and so they like to have some habitat nearby. Now, you might say, I've had people call me and say, well, gee, I put up this feeder, and I have the most expensive bird feed, and nothing's here. I said, well, tell me a little bit about your yard. I said, where, for example, is the nearest shrub? Oh, we don't have any shrubs. Okay. Where's the nearest tree? Oh, we don't have any trees. So you think about that. Here's a feeder sitting out in the middle of an open area where there's no trees or shrubs to feel safe. And this particular person was complaining that they didn't have any birds coming, even though they bought all this expensive feed. It's because they didn't have any habitat nearby for the birds to stage from to fly to the feeder and then back to the cover. So I said, why don't you take your discarded Christmas tree or that of your neighbor's and create a little habitat 6 to 10 feet away from your feeder. You can even lay the trees down if you want through the winter, or you can stand them in Christmas stands out there. And even a single Christmas tree will do a lot of good. But if you put 2 or 3 or 4 or more out there away from the feeder, you might be surprised. And sure enough, he called me a week later and said, oh, my golly, we've got all kinds of birds now because of the trees you put out there. And I said, exactly. So they have to feel safe in order to come to the feeder. So you need to have some habitat nearby. Now, you don't want it too close. I say 6 to 10 feet because predators can hide in the cover as well, cats and other things. And you'll get squirrels that will jump, as they do to some of our feeders, will jump to the feeder or come up the pole or down the tree trunk, whatever, to your feeder.
They're very, very resourceful. And I love to watch the squirrels, but I understand that they can eat you out of house and home if you're trying to support a bunch of bird feeders.
Yeah, we've had between 7 and 12 squirrels at a single time. Now, if they're on the ground cleaning up spilled feed, that's fine with me. If they were all on my feeders, I would really object. So they're fun to watch for a while.
Do you have a good solution for keeping the squirrels off of your feeders? I'm sure you've tried almost everything.
Oh, yeah, lots of things. And you can go on the internet and find how squirrels, they're very smart little buggers, and they have solved all sorts of problems to get to the feed. So we do things like squirrel baffles, which are pieces of metal that keep them from getting, they can climb up a pole, but they can't get up over the feeder, or to the feeder. We placed, I've cut off branches, I've put I hang them from certain ways, a certain distance from a roof or a branch or anything, and yet some still figure it out. they will leap from great distances to get to a feeder sometimes. So the leapers, there are chemicals, for example, that are have capsaicin, which is the hot in hot peppers. If you took some cayenne peppers and ground them up, mix them with your bird feed, most squirrels don't like that because they have strong taste buds. Birds don't have those taste buds, and so birds can go through it and it doesn't bother them at all. but it tends to keep squirrels away. I have found that certain squirrels, though, like Mexican food, just like some of us do. And those squirrels really go for that feed. So it doesn't always work. So you may have to resort to scaring them away by various means. And if you're just sitting watching for a long time, it's not hard to do. It causes them to at least eat less.
Yeah. Well, and you may have to put in a little bit of elbow grease to protect your feeders, too. I know that you actually carry some of your feeders in at night to keep the deer from knocking them down.
Yeah, we do. Last year we had, in fact, it may happen again because in a hike out on our property yesterday, there were at least seven deer on our property. So, depending on how the deer herd increases through the winter, and they often do, I may take anywhere from 1 to 5 or 6 feeders in at night and put them back out in the morning. So it's can be a challenge, but
and a hobby. All right, Jim, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about bird feeding and bird watching in Iowa. We'll get to your calls in just a moment as well. You are welcome to join us. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me this hour, Jim Pease, Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count is the nation's longest-running community science bird project. It originated 120 years ago and has been going strong for decades. This hour, we'll talk about the Christmas bird count and bird watching and bird feeding in Iowa. And, of course, with us, one of our favorite bird enthusiasts, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Charity, and Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, too. Also with us today is Doug Haar, Director of the Iowa Audubon Society. Hello, Doug.
Hi, Charity, and hi, Jim, too.
Happy New Year to
hi,
you,
Doug.
And Doug, why don't you start us off? Give us a little bit of background about the Christmas bird count. I already mentioned that the history goes back a long way, but tell us how it works.
It does go back a long way, and from the original, when it first started, they've kind of changed things a little bit, but probably for essentially the last century, it's been that basically leaders from different Audubon chapters across the United States, and then it spread to Canada and even some other countries, but basically those Audubon chapters would sponsor a local Christmas bird count in their area, which is held from mid-December to the early part of January. And they just pick out a date, and then they try to get a lot of local bird enthusiasts to volunteer to come out and spend the day, or at least a portion of the day, counting all the birds within a 15-mile diameter circle. So, for example, here I take part in about 3 different ones here in central Iowa, one in Madison County and the one in Boone County where I live, and also the one at Ames, which Jim and I both worked on this year. And this is just the way they're done all over the country. And actually, there's literally probably thousands of them across the country in Canada now, and the number is growing every year. This year, I think we probably have somewhere around 54 or 55 of these counts being done across the state of Iowa. So it's something that's really just continuing to grow.
When you go out and you get a bunch of volunteers to come with you to count birds in this 15-mile diameter circle, I mean, what kind of knowledge do the volunteers have to bring to this?
Well, most of them come with pretty good knowledge about birds. I mean, they've been enthusiastic bird watchers for a long time. But also, we like to really invite people who are just getting a little bit of interest in birds, and maybe they don't feel real efficient at trying to identify things, but we like to put them with teams that know the birds well, and they go out to work together. And that way, it helps a lot of people learn more about birds and how to count them, too.
And of course, I mean, the number of volunteers that you get to cover that territory makes a big difference in the kind of count that you get. How many volunteers do you need?
Well, really as many as possible. I think a lot of the counts in Iowa will have somewhere between 15 to 30 volunteers. And so that 15-mile circle, diameter circle that's created for each count will then be divided up into territories. For example, the one at Ames that we just did a couple of weeks ago, I believe, is divided into either 7 or 8 territories, and there will usually be from 2 to 4 or 5 people working each different territory. So they can spend a lot of time covering that area. But, of course, there can be some bad situations. I remember years ago trying to do one up at during a blizzard up at Spirit Lake when I was working for DNR up there, and we only had 4 of us show up for blizzard day. And all we could do is count birds for half a day until we couldn't see anything anymore.
So once the volunteers have gone out and counted, how do you use the information that they collect?
Well, the information is all compiled, and then it's sent into the National Audubon Society, and they compile all of that for the entire country to give them a good count on what birds are doing at this time of year, wintering birds in North America and Central America, basically. And so this is all very valuable information that goes to the National Audubon Society, and actually this is, the longest-running and oldest bird count of any kind in the world that has been used to kind of predict what's happening to birds.
Can you give me an example of something you've been able to learn from the Iowa bird count over the years?
Well, I've personally learned that there seems to be some changes in where birds are being seen. We tend to be seeing some more birds from a little bit further south here in central Iowa and northern Iowa. And that's probably an indication of some climate change. As the winters get a little bit milder and shorter overall, we may have a few more birds that maybe don't migrate quite as far south, spend a little bit more time in Iowa, and so we find those on our counts. And actually, this is what National Audubon is really concerned about, and why they're really trying to compile all this data and look at it over the years to see just how bird population numbers are changing during the winter and the species lists are changing during the winter, and how that might actually tell us something about what climate change is doing.
Well, and one of the things, Jim, I know that is most exciting to you about the Christmas bird count is the fact that we have citizen scientists involved in doing this count and collecting this data. Why is that so exciting for you?
Well, I think that the more people that we involve in the process of science, in counting birds and counting wildlife of all kinds, getting out and observing, the more people are involved in science, the more it not only validates that science, but the more people then value science and believe in science. And we can see the results when people don't believe in science and don't follow what scientists do or how they do it. I think it's just really, really important. Citizen science is a way of not only doing better science, I think, because we have more people looking in this case especially, but it helps science in general in a wide spectrum for people to be involved with it. They don't see it as something that's sort of other out there, this great mystery that they can't participate in it. Rather, they do participate in it, and it makes a lot more sense to them then, I think.
Well, and we've talked about the frog count in Iowa, which is another opportunity for citizen scientists in the state to get involved. I'll bet there are lots of frog counters that are also bird counters. And I want to ask you, Doug, before we let you go, you've mentioned going out on a specific day and covering this territory, but there's also an opportunity for people who feed birds to get involved too, right?
Yes, there is. And very often we'll have some elderly people who can't really get outdoors and do a lot of hiking or driving around, and they will volunteer to do feeder counts. Just watch the birds for the day or for a few hours out their backyard windows and see what is all is there. And then they can submit that to the local coordinator for the particular circular count, and that will all be added into the birds that are counted for that particular bird count. So that's also very very important. In fact, actually, when I did the Boone County count here a week ago, I took a lunch break and came home and counted the birds that were in my backyard, and I think I had 13 or 14 species of birds at the feeders in my backyard. So that's just kind of an example of how important it can be to have people who maybe they can't get outdoors or aren't able to do the walking around and looking for the birds, but they can certainly add a lot of help by counting what they see in their yards.
Well, and Jim, I know that you volunteer to spend many days looking at the birds outside your windows, even when there isn't a count
right.
going on. This is part that you love to do as well, right?
Yeah, I've done both. My wife and I have both participated for many, many years in the Christmas bird count, and particularly with the feeder counts here at home, because we've got a property that attracts a lot of birds. And we have a lot of birds in our feeders, and we usually have between 15 and 17 or 18 different species that we contribute to the Christmas bird count. Now, most Christmas bird counts, what do they have in terms of species totals or the numbers of species totals in Boone County? In Story County, I think we had 69 different species. What was it in Boone? Do you recall?
In Boone County, it was 53, I believe. We were down a little bit from last year, but the amazing thing was some of the bird numbers were way up, like bald eagles, both in Boone and Story counties. I think they were almost new record numbers for the Christmas bird counts this year.
Yeah, and it's always impressive. And that's one of the things that I think is interesting, to look at these trends over time. You see not only changes in species, but changes in the numbers of species. We had this year in Story County and in the Christmas bird count here in Ames, we had 13,400 crows, which is because we have a crow roost here in the city of Ames on the Iowa State University campus and elsewhere. We have a lot of. It's kind of fun to watch that over the years. It kind of ebbs and flows with various diseases, and so you can watch those changes in the counts.
And how long does it take to put all of the information together, Doug? I mean, you've been out doing the counting. When do we get access to results?
Well, it's kind of up to the coordinator of each different count. Now, everybody who does the count tries to get their list and numbers of birds sent to the coordinator as quickly as possible, very often the same evening of the count or the next day. And that's a lot easier today with different telephone apps and emails and everything else. It's a lot quicker to get the numbers to the local coordinator than it was years ago when they had to be mailed in or something like that. But then the coordinator may take about a week generally to put everything together and get that ready to submit to National Audubon, and then also provide a copy of that to all the different people who volunteered on a particular count so they know what all they helped see.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, Doug Haar, director of the Iowa Audubon Society, and Jim Pease, emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. We are talking about the Christmas bird count and bird watching in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.